This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated. I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
This is the Woman's Hour podcast for Tuesday, the 10th of November, with me, Anita Rani. Good morning and welcome to Woman's Hour. We have a packed show for you today. Now, how many of you do the same job as your mum? I'll be talking to a mother and son, both in the same profession and both smashing stereotypes. They're football referees, so if you've ever fancied doing it as a career, keep listening. Now, have you ever dreamt of the good life? An allotment to grow your own produce, maybe an organic leek or a bunch of coriander, and while away the hours in your own serene patch of green? Well, lots of women do, and the numbers have shot up. So why are men losing their plots to women? I'll be finding out. A new book is coming out that looks at the life of two leading women during the miners' strike, Anne Scargill and Betty Cook, who started the Women Against Pit Closure movement. They supported their husbands, kept their own and other families going, and opened up their own worlds in the process. So I'm really looking forward to speaking with Betty Cook a little bit later. And if you are that way inclined, you can follow us on social media, Twitter and Instagram, and our hashtag is at BBC Woman's Hour. But first, COVID-19 has been difficult for everyone, but one group who've been on the front line of fighting the pandemic are critical care nurses. There are reports of record sickness levels, partly due to stress and mental health issues. I can talk now to Nikki Credland, who chairs the British Association of Critical Care Nurses. Good morning, Nikki. Welcome to the programme.
It must be
incredibly stressful working in intensive care with COVID patients. So how have your staff been telling you about what's going on? Just how bad is it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And I think it's worth just, first of all, explaining that our staff that work in critical care units are usually very resilient staff. We're used to dealing with, sadly, patients that die, very complicated patients, a very complicated physiology and using very technical machinery, etc. So, you know, the fact that they are feeling this so significantly and are really struggling with the psychological trauma that is now associated with caring for these patients during the first surge is a really significant situation for our staff at the moment.
How's it been affecting them?
So we've got a lot of staff off sick across the NHS, not just in terms of critical care nurses, but partly in due to the fact that our staff are getting COVID themselves, just like every other member of the population, partly because they're self-isolating, because members of their family or their friendship group have got COVID, but equally because of the psychological and physical pressures that are brought on by looking after very, very complex patients in high volumes who sadly die.
So, but just what's the impact on their mental health? Just how serious is it getting? Just how concerned are you, Nikki?
I'm very, very concerned. I've spoken to numerous staff up and down the country and further afield. This isn't just isolated to Great Britain. This is an international global problem. And I've spoken to staff who are receiving post-traumatic stress counselling, who have been sectioned under the Mental Health Act, who are needing significant time off sick, this is affecting not only their ability to be able to work and to be able to do the job that they chose to train to do, but it's also affecting their home lives, their relationships with their families, their friends, etc.
Goodness me, sectioned.
Yes, it's a really significant problem. And until anybody actually walks into an intensive care unit and actually understands the role of an intensive care nurse, it's very difficult to explain that to anybody else. Hmm. You know, like I've said, these are very technically difficult patients to look after. There's a lot of machinery, a lot of equipment, which needs expert skill to be able to manage. And we also have to think about the impact that not having families on our intensive care units have on our staff. You know, intensive care units build a real relationship, a real rapport with those families. And that's a two-way relationship. And we give families strength, and equally, you know, families give us strength to be able to look after the people that they have entrusted to us to look to care for.
Yeah, because
a really difficult situation.
Yeah, because as you said, you know, critical care nurses, they are used to working with very unwell people. They're used to dealing with distressed families, and they also used to, sadly, because it's part of the job, the death of patients. So people might be wondering why it's so different now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a number of things that are different now. And I've already touched on the element associated particularly with the patients and the lack of relationship, the ability to form relationships with the families. But we also have to remember that we simply don't have enough intensive care nurses. So the way that we usually manage these patients on a one ICU nurse to one patient basis, because of the complexity of these patients, is simply not possible because we simply do not have the staff. So what we've had to do is we've had to change the way that we work. So we've maybe got one ICU nurse with a nurse or an operating department practitioner or another health professional who doesn't traditionally work in a critical care environment being redeployed into intensive care to support that. Now that again just adds another layer of stress to that intensive care nurse, because now not only are they responsible for their own practice, but they're overseeing someone else when this environment isn't something that is they're not used to it. It's a very different environment for them.
Now, we asked NHS England about critical care nurses and capacity, and they said that the NHS has 13,000 more full-time equivalent nurses than they did last year, and that record numbers have signed up to start nursing degrees this autumn. Do you think we'll be seeing more people coming into the profession after this pandemic, inspired by nurses and what they're seeing now? And how long will it take before realistically we can see more trained up nurses in ICU?
So if we just take these questions separately, so if we think about intensive care, in order to become a registered nurse, you need to go to university for 3 years. So it's a three-year degree programme. Half of that time is spent in clinical practice and half of that time is spent doing academic study. At the end of that 3 years, if you choose to specialise in intensive care, you then need to work in intensive care and get hands-on bedside education to be able to manage patients, and you also need to do academic study alongside that. So it takes another year to 18 months until you become a competent, qualified intensive care nurse. So we're talking about between 4 and 4.5 years to produce a competent intensive care nurse. That's how significant this is.
So it's going to take a little while. I mean, how do your findings and the figures compare to this time last year? Because this is an intense job at the best of times, isn't it? So are we seeing a significant increase because of what they're having to deal with COVID?
It is. And I think, you know, numbers can be manipulated. You know, it's very easy to give a set of numbers without any background to it. You know, we talk about this figure of 13,000, and that's really interesting. We know that if we look on the Nursing and Midwifery Council website, we know how many nurses are registered to work. But that doesn't mean that all of those nurses are either working or working in the NHS. So that 13,000 figure, it is questionable at best.
NHS England are putting forward an extra £15 million specifically for mental health support. How far will this go, Nikki?
I mean, it's absolutely welcome, and it's something that we absolutely 100% need. You know, we have got to find a way of protecting our staff. We are asking them to go above and beyond what we would expect of anybody under normal circumstances. This is unprecedented. We are in a position that, you know, we could never have imagined happening even 2-3 years ago. You know, we really need to look after them. there's no point thinking about getting more nurses into the profession if when they're in the profession, they leave. So we've got to think about retention of staff as well. And how can we make sure that we look after the staff that are looking after the patients so that they want to stay in nursing, they want to stay in intensive care? Because what I'm hearing is that a lot of them at the moment are so demoralised by what we're putting them through that they're thinking about changing profession completely. And that is really sad and an absolute loss to the NHS.
And the Derby Royal, I was reading, have taken matters into their own hands and created something called a wobble room for all their staff. It's like a time-out place, a place with uplifting and supporting messages for the staff who might just need to, you know, maybe even just go and have a cry during the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really important. And that's certainly popping up in various pockets across the UK. It's not a national initiative, so it is about individual trusts taking the responsibility for the care and welfare of the staff themselves. And that's really important and absolutely welcomed. And we really do need to remember that, you know, we have got to look after our staff. We've got to be kind to each other. We've got to realise that this is a really, really stressful situation. And quite rightly, some of our nursing staff and doctors and operating department practitioners and all of the other health professionals are going to find this really stressful. And they may just need to take a step away for 10 minutes and, like you say, have a cry, get themselves together and then go back to work again. So we've really got to support these staff during this time.
OK, Nikki, thank you very much. That's Nikki Credlin there, the chair of the British Association of Critical Care Nurses. Now, a new study reveals women with allotment plots outnumber men for the first time. A recent study by Imperial College found that in London, almost two-thirds of plots, 64%, are now occupied by women. The National Allotment Society estimates that half of holders nationally are now women, compared to just 2% in 1973. They are no longer just the preserve of men as they once were, including my granddad, who loved his allotment. So let's talk now to Dr. Tilly Collins from Imperial, and also allotment holders Irene O'Malley in Loughborough and Sonia Hyman in Birmingham. Morning to you all.
Morning.
Tilly.
Good morning.
Tilly, your research, tell us about this data that you found. It's a very different picture than what you expected. What did it show?
It was a different picture, Anita. I, in common with many people, had the expectation that this was a largely male preserve. But the interest that we had, and that Ellen really had in this project, was to look at what's happening to the urban green space and how is it changing. And her vehicle was to look at allotment spaces. She was fabulously thorough and managed to get data from almost 400 of the 700-ish sites in London.
Who's Ellen? Sorry, Tilly. Tell us about Ellen.
Ellen Fletcher was the student who worked on this.
Fantastic.
She's excellent, excellent student, and I can't commend her highly enough because she did a really thorough and detailed job on this, ferreting out data and pushing people to get answers to questions, which was really, really thorough. So we have a lot of really accurate data that gives a good baseline for last summer. So since then we've had COVID, and the demand for allotment plots has just rocketed. Last summer we calculated it was about 30,000 people waiting for allotment plots in London. Now it is much, much higher. And one of the things that's happened is that to kind of buffer that demand is that they're splitting plots in half. So instead of having a plot which is one chain, and they're measured in these wonderful archaic measures of chains, and a chain is about 20 metres long, you now find that they're being either split in half or even into quarter.
Right, to make space because so many people want them. But what do you put the increase of women having plots down to? What's changed?
I think that the allotments originally were very, very much about food provision, but also about a space where men could go and be and have some space outside the family. And they were very much a working class environment. It was largely working class men who grew food for their families, and at a chain plot size, you can provide for a family. They are now places that are more valued for the relaxation and the mental health benefits. People rank recreation above food production. And at a smaller plot size, you don't provide fully food for a family. You may get a lot of courgettes in the summer months. but you're not getting food for a whole family. It's much more a demonstration kind of space and a relaxation kind of space, with the added satisfaction of producing some food.
I'm going to bring Sonia in here, because Sonia, you're one of the few women who did have an allotment plot 50 years ago.
Yes.
Why did you first get an allotment, Sonia?
Well, I got an allotment because my father, when I was young, gave me a small little plot, and I thought, oh, I'm going to do that. And I sort of worked away from then. I enjoyed it. So when I come to England, settle down, go to college, uni, get married, and my husband got a plot, you know, and I enjoyed it so much. You know, it was amazing, you know, to know you can grow your own and see the joy on your face to see what you've grown. That's why I got a plot. And the enjoyment of the relaxation as well, you know, it was really lovely.
And your first allotment that your dad got you, that was in Jamaica, was it, when you were little? And so what did you grow when you got your allotment in Birmingham?
Well, I grow all sorts, sweet corns, cabbage, carrots, you know, loads of little things that grows in England, because many of the things that grows in Jamaica does not grow here. So we try to grow to adapt to the climate here, because many of the things does not grow in this country that grows in Jamaica. So we adapt to what grows in this country.
Oh, absolutely, you've got to do that. And were you rare as a woman in the allotments? Did you notice that there were mainly men?
I was, well, at the time, it was about when we got our plot, it was about two or three women on the plot. And it was very strange, because the men used to pass and comment when I was digging and I was planting, you know. They said, oh, you shouldn't be on the plot. You should be at home looking after your husband and your children. You know what I mean? Well, they let you feel sort of dominant. But that didn't put me off, because my first love was gardening. So it did not put me off. I just continued doing it.
Good, you know? Sonia. I'm pleased to hear that. I'm going to bring Irene in. No men walking past you now, Irene, are they telling you should be at home looking after the kids?
Good morning, Anita, and thank you for having me on your programme. No men telling me to go home. My kids have all grown up. But, however, I do bring my grandchildren to the allotment with me, and they enjoy it very much.
Now, you must just be so delighted, because you've had yours for a year. The waiting list for allotments are years long.
I think I struck lucky, really. I gave up work in 2019 by choice, and I was pondering of what I could do with my time, so I decided I'd apply for allotment, thinking I would wait 6 months or a year. And within 6 weeks, I was allocated half a plot. And I was like, oh my God, what do I do now? I didn't expect this so quickly. It just happened to be there at the time. And when I saw the allotment, first visit, it was just an overgrown jungle full of brambles, and it had been left for about a year. However, I thought, no, don't be dispirited by this. And I started to cultivate it, and each little patch I cultivated was inspiring. And you just plod through it, and eventually you get there.
And what's the appeal?
The appeal is you grow your own food, and you see the food through from your plot to your plate at home within weeks sometimes, and it's just wonderful. And there's no carbon footprint, because I cycle to the allotment those days. And I try to garden organic there, and I also compost everything for it.
And have you found a community?
Oh, the community is brilliant, because when you first go, everybody knows you're new, obviously. So they're all willing to give you advice, share ideas, knowledge, even produce. The first year I came home each day laden down with produce, because I wasn't growing anything. I was just cultivating plot. So people were really generous, because everybody has a glut.
That sounds lovely.
Just share what they have.
I mean, I need to get my name on a list. Tilly, how long are these waiting lists in councils? Will I ever get an allotment in my lifetime?
Well, if you're in London, you will get an allotment, but you may have retired by then. About 20% of the councils have closed their list, because the demand is so high. It's so inspiring that people are using the green space in this way, in this active way, because it brings so many health benefits that I think the councils are forgiven for splitting the plots because it does increase the numbers of people who can access this.
But who is accessing them? What are the demographics? As he said, in the kind of when my granddad had one, it definitely was growing coriander and fenugreek. If anyone's interested, because you couldn't get them in Britain in the 60s. Is it still working class people who are getting the allotments now? How have the politics changed?
Well, certainly in London, and I can only really talk about London. I don't know about the rest of the country, but in London, the plot politics are quite competitive, and it's largely middle class women who are getting the plots. It's largely middle class women who are on the waiting lists. They're established in the community. They have the time to wait. Their children are leaving home, and they're patient about it. Whereas the men are, I think, less patient about getting on the waiting lists and more mobile. So they're getting fewer and fewer of the plots that are given out. And I think that whilst it's really, really wonderful that women are getting lots of plots, we have to keep an eye on the equality of these places. We also know that in London, there's 90% white. There's only about 10% of people from the ethnic minorities who have plots. And that we need to encourage, and we need to try and make these places accessible and representative of the society that's around them. And to do that, we may have to address some of the competitive politics about getting up the list and onto the plots.
Sonia, what advice would you give to someone who's just got, or maybe is just thinking about getting an allotment?
Well, you know, as I say, you get a small plot to start off with, and then, you know, you work your way up from there, take it bit at a time. And it's for them to know, once you get there and you've done it, it's absolutely marvellous. They'll enjoy it, you know. So I advise anybody who's thinking of taking on a plot to take a small plot, go from there, do it bit by bit. Don't overdo it, because it is hard work. But once you've done it, you're amazed of what you can achieve, and it's brilliant.
I'm totally inspired by all of you. Irene, Tilly, Sonia, thank you very much. And I bet they were absolutely delightfully happy to have their allotments during lockdown. Now, still to come in today's Woman's Hour, the mother and son who are both working as football referees. But last week, we talked about how to boost your confidence if you're at rock bottom, whether that's returning to work after having a baby, having responsibilities as a carer, or after a relationship breakdown. Frances Monaghan is from Wise Women, which runs confidence courses in Glasgow. She told us how negativity and positivity can be infectious.
One of the exercises that we do is look at, where does low self-esteem come from? And for that exercise, one of the things we use is called an iceberg exercise. So we're looking at the influences in women's lives, because the bottom line is you're not born with low self-esteem or low self-confidence. It's something that's created, and it's created through many, many influences from your, you know, family, teachers, school, religious leaders, the social media, you name it. Everything you have seen and heard and experienced in your entire life will shape how you feel about yourself. And if some of that's negative, then we are addressing that, because what tends to happen with women, we find in the work that we do, is that women will always blame themselves for low self-esteem. Women will always say, like, I'm just being stupid, or like, I'm just a bit useless, and I'm a bit pathetic, and they're that kind of self-critical voice that they hear, that's something that's been learned. So we focus on breaking that down and looking at the blame and the shame and the guilt culture and trying to replace that with something else.
But you get people to say something about themselves, don't you?
Yes, that's one of our favourite ones. Basically, where that came from was I was doing a session on working with women with complex needs for staff, and we try to get the staff to do exercises that we do in the courses. So I started off by saying, just out of the blue, tell me something about yourself, and I pointed to someone, and the first thing everybody does is go, so I write that up, anything you like, say anything you like. So there was a woman in the room who said, she started and she says, well, I've got a fat backside and my roots need done. And everybody kind of laughed, and I wrote that up. and they were wondering why I did that. So then the next person said something negative, and the next person said something negative, and you could tell there was somebody in the back of the room who was itching to say something positive, and she said, I'm going to learn how to play the guitar. And everybody in the room went, oh. So the energy immediately changed. And the point of that was that negativity is quite infectious, but so is positivity. So it's replacing the negative with the positive.
I love that. I have been saying I want to learn to play the piano for the last 11 years. One day I'll do it. That was Frances Monaghan uplifting us and talking to Chloe Tilley there. Now, our article giving tips on how to build confidence is up on our website. And don't forget, if you miss the live programme, you can catch up by downloading the BBC Sounds app. Search for Woman's Hour and you'll find all of our episodes. Click on an episode to listen right away or download for later. You can also subscribe to Woman's Hour so you never miss a programme. And of course, you can follow us on social media at BBC Woman's Hour. Now, Anne Scargill and Betty Cook met at the beginning of the miners' strike in 1984. Betty was a proud miner's daughter, wife and mother who was determined to support her family and community. Anne happened to be married to Arthur Scargill, the president of the miners' union. She too was steeped in the history of coalfield culture. Together they helped to create the Women Against Pit Closures movement. They've just published a book called Anne and Betty, United in the Struggle, and Betty joins me from Barnsley along with Ian Clayton, who helped gather the material for the book. Welcome to the programme, both of you. Very good morning.
Good morning.
Betty, you were the daughter of a miner and married to one too. Tell us a bit about the community you lived in. What was your life like before the miners' strike?
Well, I lived in a very small, isolated community. Most of the men worked at the pit there, and it was a close-knit community, but it was one that you were judged on how you presented your children, how well they were dressed, what you bought from the butchers or the grocers, and how white your washing was on the line. So I never felt that I was me. I just felt that I was classed as somebody's wife or somebody's mother.
And then you met Anne, didn't you? Tell me how you first met Anne Scargill.
I first met Anne when I went to the first meeting that I was aware of Women Against Pit Closures, the Barnsley Women Against Pit Closures meeting. I had been in the community trying to organise a soup kitchen, and someone gave me a telephone number to ring. If you ring this number, there'll be a meeting on the Sunday and you'll be able to go there. So I went along to the meeting, and that's when I met Anne for the very first time.
And you said, you know, you were judged by how white your washing was, and, you know, you never felt like yourself. What gave you the confidence and the courage and the want to go out and, you know, be involved in this?
Okay. During 1972 and 74 strikes, my husband was a flying picket. I was left at home with the children, and we were often cold and hungry. And I cried a lot during 72 and 74. But when we came into 84, I recognised that the strike was going to be a long strike, and I determined that I wasn't going to sit and cry. I was going to get up and I was going to get involved. So I moved from full-time work to part-time work that would give me more time to work in the community.
I mean, Ian, it's such a powerful and inspiring story that the women who were involved in this Women Against Pit Closures movement, you helped Anne and Betty write the book. Anne isn't well enough to join us today, but she's given you permission to speak on her behalf. So tell us a bit about Anne. How did she first meet Arthur Scargill?
Arthur Scargill came and knocked on a dad and mum's back door one day to talk to her dad, and Anne was coming home from her own work for a lunch, and she asked him who he was, and he said, "I'm Arthur Scargill." So that's how they met.
And that was that.
But I mean, Anne's given me, as you say, Anne's given me permission to talk to you about this. And I think one of the things that Anne always says is that a book is forever. And writing one's like being an eyewitness to your own life. And I think that's why they wanted to get this story down in words. And it's a bit difficult for working class women sometimes to get, well, working class people in general, to get the words out into books. I was thinking that this morning, you know, it was Vita Sackville-West who talked about how you compel the growth of pattern with a patient shuttle. And she came from a very different social background to Anne and Betty, but their story is just as colourful and intricate, a tapestry. Mm. It's about how people craft their own life stories. And, you know, of course, Anne and Betty have got wonderful yarns to spin as well. And so that's why I wanted to get involved, if that answers your question.
Yeah, and Anne was arrested, wasn't she? I mean, it really did change their lives completely being involved in this movement.
It did. I think it's... and that again, that's another reason why it's important for them to get it down in their book, because they're both getting older. Anne said that to me. She said, I'm getting older now. And when I think back and try to make sense of my life, I want my grandkids and then perhaps my great-grandkids to know what their granny did during the strike and how brave they were, because it wasn't easy to stand up for yourself as Anne and Betty did. A lot of stories were being told that weren't particularly true, and they wanted to have their three penneth.
Absolutely, own their stories. Well, we've got a clip of Anne. She was arrested, and this is her talking to Jenny Murray in November 2013 about her experience.
Actually, it was the first picket that I ever went on. We organised pickets to go into Nottinghamshire. Actually, it was at Silver Hill Pit, and there were only 12 of us in this minibus. And we went to this pit, and there were only about 6 police there. And then we were coming away from the picket and a police van drove up, and we learnt a lot from this, because the policemen got out and put their chin straps on their helmets, and then they came to us and they started pushing us about. Anyway, one or two girls resisted them and then they arrested them. So I went up to inspector and said to him, excuse me, officer, I said, I don't want to be rude. I said, but what, you arrested them for? What have they done? He says, get her and all. So I got arrested for asking what somebody had done to get arrested. Anyway, they took us to the police station and they put us in a dock compound. And then they fetched us out one by one, and this policewoman took me in this cell, small cell. She said to me name, and I wouldn't tell her my name. I says, I'll tell you what they call me when you tell me what I've done wrong. I says, what are you doing this for? She says, we're looking for offensive weapons and drugs. I says, offensive weapons and drugs? I said, I've never been in a police station in my life. She says, come on, get undressed. Well, I took my clothes off and then I got dressed again, and she wouldn't give me my shoes back. I said, I'm not walking about in here. I says, do you know I'm old enough to be your mother?
And I can hear in your voice that it still upsets you, that intimate search. What impact did it have on you?
Terrible. When I saw a policeman, or even now, when I see a policeman in uniform, it really, really upsets me.
Really powerful clip that. Betty, I mean, this whole movement, being involved in it, it completely changed your lives, doesn't it? And you went on marches and you went on the picket lines and you also saw terrible violence, didn't you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The police didn't make any difference whether you were a man or a woman. They often would attack you and push you up and down. And it was a horrible time. I'd always looked at the police as caring people that were there to help. I just couldn't believe that I could see such a change in attitude and how horrible they were.
And it changed your life, didn't it, Betty, the miners' strike? It ended in March 1985. Did it give you confidence to do other things?
It certainly did. I suddenly realised there was a wide world out there. And I just didn't always necessarily need to be a wife or a mother. And I realised during the strike, seeking it in different places, that maybe I should get some education after the strike finished. So in 1987, I went to Northern College for 2 years. The aim was, once I'd finished the course in college, to go back and work in the community. But I got dragged into the system and I went to Sheffield University and did a degree. And it was quite amazing because my parents' ambition for me was always to achieve what they called the cap and gown. And they were desperately disappointed when I came out of education as a 16-year-old. But it was a lovely, wonderful day for my mum. I'd lost my dad by then, but mum came to the graduation ceremony and her face was just a picture. You know, if it hadn't been for the miners' strike, I would have never have done that. I would have never achieved the independence, what I did. And I suddenly became me. I was a person and I came me.
Oh, Betty, it's such an amazing thing to hear. I'm so proud of you for doing that as well. Ian, Betty's not alone, is she, in this regard? The speed of change for women's lives was so fast around this time, wasn't it?
Anne tells a lovely story, you know, Anita, about the day the strike ended. And, of course, all the people who'd been on strike and stuck it out through all that horrible year marched back with a lot of pride behind their bands and flying their banners. And a bloke came up to Anne and said, I'm glad that it's over for another thing, and at least I'm going to get my wife back now. And Anne says, well, either might, lad. And he said, but I don't want her back how she is now. I want her back how she was. And Anne turned around to him and winked at him and said, that's not going to happen, cock.
I love
because
it.
Because there was so much change.
Absolutely. So rapidly. I mean, we could carry on. I really could talk to both of you all day, but we haven't got time. But Ian and Betty, thank you so much for joining me. And if you do want to know more, as I do, the book is Anne and Betty, United by Struggle. So go and track it down. Now, Patsy Andrews has been a football referee for the last 16 years, one of only 2,146 women across all levels of the game. Her son, Akil Housen, has followed in his mum's footsteps and is now officiating in the English Football League Championship. Welcome to the programme, both of you. Patsy, what made you want to give it a go and try your hand at football refereeing 16 years ago?
What forced me into doing it was one Saturday afternoon, I'd taken my son to, well, I was went to collect my son from his football training, and the manager at the time said to all the parents in front of the children, does anyone want to be a football referee? We've got free courses. So I said, at that time, I said it as a joke because I just thought, okay, humour, let me put my hands up and said, I'll volunteer to do it. I was told in front of everybody, I wasn't talking to you, Patsy, I was talking to the dads. At that time, and the way things were at that time, it was kind of, everyone thought that was the norm. However, the way I've raised my children to actually aspire to anything they want to aspire to. And so 2 days later, I phoned up the FA and decided I'm not going to allow that message to get across to my children. And I booked myself on a refereeing course, and there you go, there I am.
Wow, that's incredible. Akil, what a mum you've got.
I know, yeah.
Tell me how you got into refereeing, because your mum had a big part to play in that, didn't she?
Yeah, she forced me. she forced me to do it. I was training one day, and I just got into a car, and she basically said, we're on the way to a referee course, I've booked you on it. And I said, no, I'm not. And obviously I couldn't drive, I couldn't really ever say, I was only 14 years of age. So yeah, she dragged me along to a referee course and sort of put me on it, and it's the best decision ever because now it's my career.
Yes, and you're doing very well at it. But Patsy, you've literally pushed him out the car to say, go on, you're doing the course. Forced your son to do it.
Yeah, it sounds really bad, doesn't it? No, Akil was struggling with playing games, and every mom, every parent out there knows when your young person is not getting the games they want to get because of an injury, they're sick, coming home upset. They're coming home crying. And what are we going to do about it? And I started refereeing and I realised, you know what? Actually, there's a lot more from refereeing. It's a part of football. And if Akil loves it that much, you know what? If you can't play it, why don't you go and officiate on it? Because there's a lot more he can get from that rather than coming home every Saturday and a Sunday upset.
I mean, this is the question. I mean, it's brilliant. So I say another brilliantly inspiring story to hear. And this is a question for both of you, but I'll start with you, Patsy. You know, about 16 years ago, you took yourself off to go and become a ref for football matches. How many women were doing it back then? How many black women were doing it? And still?
you know what, black women, there was none that I knew of. And so I had no one to look up to learn from, apart from my son. In terms of women, we were trying to remember yesterday, and I think there were probably two women in Leicestershire that I knew of were referees. And that was my main reason. When I took my kids, my son played, my daughter played football, there were no people that reflected black women. There was no women that ever refereed their games. And so, no, it was a very isolating role at that time. But I'm really pleased to see that there's a lot more coming up, and there's some really positive ones coming up. But no, at the time, I had to find my support from other males because there was no other female referees at the time.
And did you get the support?
I've got a very small group of very good referees, including Akhil. My nephew was a referee, and I've met some over the years some really interesting referees who have always been there for me. So, yeah, I got it from the avenues I needed to get it from to get me through. And I'm not going to sit here and say at all it was easy, because people in my community laughed at me at those times. People who weren't even from my community laughed at me. The pressure that was put on me on the pitch from everybody wasn't easy at all. But you know what? Out of the negatives came the positive. And the positive, it gave me so much confidence. Akhil will tell you, my Saturdays and Sundays, when we're not in lockdown, is on the football pitch. Because for me, it's given me so many skills in terms of people skills and relationships. So although I didn't get the support I needed at the time from the other black people, black women, I got the support from people who were in the game already.
Yeah.
And now people value what I've done, because what I've done is reflected a positive role model for people in my community.
Yeah, absolutely, Patsy. You're a pioneer. I mean, Akhil, how does your experience reflect what your mum's saying? Because, of course, there aren't that many black men either who are refereeing at the moment.
No, it's strange when you're looking back. I never really had a role model looking up to it, and I never really thought that I'd get to the level that I'm at. I literally just took the course, and I had no intentions of ever being a referee as well. It was just unthought of. It was a thing that you just didn't do. And then sort of just going through the ranks, and you start to realise that you're sort of one of few, you're a minority. You put a bit of pressure on yourself, but it's good pressure, because hopefully you can then pave a way for the next generation. So
you are paving the way. You're doing very well. Are you hoping, where's the next step for you? What's your ambition? Premier League, Akhil?
Yeah, that's the ambition. So, yeah, I've just got to work hard and try and get to the Premier League.
And Patsy, what's the best bit of the job? Actually, but both of you, very quickly, what's it like when your mum's made a decision, Akhil, that you disagree with?
As a referee watching, it's hard. As a son watching, it's funny, because you get to see that your mum's not perfect. So, yeah.
And the best bit of the job, Patsy?
Listen, going out there and reflecting positive images for my community is all I'm about. So if I retire tomorrow, anyone who's listening, mums, we can do it. Black women, we can do it. Our children are in it. So therefore, we need to be in it and understand it. Because it's so beautiful. When my son phones me from a game, "Mum, you're watching my game?" And he asks me, "Was that the right decision?" That's because he knows I'm involved in that world of his. And at the end of the day, that for me is the positivity of it.
That was Patsy Andrews and Akhil Howson. We've had a great response to today's show. On critical care nurses, which was our first item, Alison has been in touch to say, "I retired 8 years ago after 42 years of full-time nursing. I gave my heart and soul to nursing and loved the job, but constantly under enormous stress due to insufficient staff levels. When, oh when," she says, "will there be proper care for nurses throughout their careers?" And she goes on to say, "My heartfelt thanks today and always to all nurses and carers in hospitals, communities and care homes. And I also extend my heartfelt thanks to everybody on the front line within the NHS at the moment." And then we chatted about women and allotments. Lots of you got in touch about this item. Lorraine said, "I live in Sheffield and have had 5 allotment plots since 1987. 5, Lorraine. She says, "Lockdown has enabled me to spend more time than ever on my allotment, making 2020 the year I had my best tended plot. November is a very busy month for me." She says, "I have become self-sufficient in compost and liquid comfort feed." Sounds technical. "There's also a history of allotment holding in our family. My grandfather tended a plot in South Wales during the years of depression and unemployment. As did mine, Lorraine. My granddad loved his. I think he loved growing things and getting away from the family in equal measure. Rachel says, my allotment has been my sanity saver. Social distanced exercise, great advice and plant sharing with other allotment holders, and a great view of the sea and countryside. Couldn't recommend it more. Oh, well, if you can get a view of the sea, absolutely. Sue says, my husband passed away last year. We'd been married for 52 years. I took on his allotment plot and I cannot describe the warm reception I was given by the community. I got the plot knocked into shape and never a day went by without an offering being placed on my shed in the way of seeds, plants or produce. This sounds lovely. Plot holders mended my bike and sharpened my tools. They helped me with heavy jobs, even to the point of moving my shed. A year on, I look back over this difficult time and I know I couldn't have survived without my allotment neighbours, who've now become friends. I know I can always find solace there. And Sophie says, I'm a woman allotmenteer. I'm surrounded by men and potatoes. I love them, but happy to hear there are others like me around. So many, Sophie, so many, and the numbers are growing. And then we talked to a wonderfully inspiring Betty and Ian about the new book about women during the miners' strike. And Mark says, I met Betty and Anne when I had just started at Manchester University as a mature student. They attended the student union meeting as the SU were hoping to donate the majority of their annual grant to support the strike. I was a union man and had a chat with them after the meeting and we had a bit of a laugh. They were brilliant. I'm sure they were. Now, tomorrow, I'll be talking to the writer, Kate Mascarenhas, about her passions for dolls and dolls' houses and her fantastic new book. Also, how can faith inspire climate change activism? And what are the major world religions doing to combat the climate crisis? We'll be discussing that. And I'll be talking to a woman who has Down syndrome and a woman who has a son with the condition to hear how they're going to the High Court to try to change the law that allows pregnancies where Down syndrome is detected to be terminated up to birth. Join me then.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the hosts of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following, to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.